Any questions from discussion group anyone would like to bring up before we move on to this afternoon's topics?
Someone asked if it was possible to exhaust your fund of merit, good karma, to draw your account down to zero.
I think the answer is no, but sometimes they, in some of the philosophical schools or traditions, they talk about different types of lineages of people, and in some of them they talk about what's called broken lineage or interrupted lineage or something like that. I can't remember the names they use, but it's basically talking about someone who, not down to zero, but who is really quite low and is sort of nowhere near moving in that direction. But
a person, like the last person in the lineage?
No, they're talking about, the presentation is about different lineages of practice. We briefly mentioned earlier, in the context of the three people, in the text it talked about the Shravaka Pratika Buddha. So these are two of the lineages, two of the approaches. So the Shravaka is the hearer, someone who's listening a lot, and the Pratika Buddha is the solitary realizer but both of those are in the lineage striving for Nirvana. And then we have the Mahayana lineage, someone who is actively moving to or striving towards enlightenment. But sometimes also they bring in another couple of lineages of people. One is called sometimes indefinite, meaning someone who's sort of got some merit and is not sure which of those approaches they're going to engage in. And then there's another one that's sometimes called disconnected or broken lineage, where someone who's really sort of bereft of merit and is struggling and suffering and not really starting anywhere. But even there, they say that, well, certainly within the Mahayana, we talk about Buddha nature. You know, the idea that we all have the potential for enlightenment. So even that sort of person, they say, is wandering in samsara for a long time, but even they will have the potential for enlightenment. So I think drawn down to zero is probably not possible. Very low, maybe.
The good karma and bad karma don't cancel out, right? One cannot just do a lot of good deed and expect the good karma to cancel their bad karma.
Of course, as we understand about these imprints in our mind, then, you know, one of the four powers was the remedy, which is some positive opposite. So, yes, they have that sort of effect. And often we see in the text is that, that's going to come up tomorrow, anger is very destructive because it sort of really burns a lot of the good imprints in our mind. And so also the good actions, of course, weaken the negative imprints. But we can't wipe out all the negative imprints by just simply doing good things. Because we need to wipe out all the negative imprints, we need to have this wisdom understanding reality. But yes, we can, you know, often, and this is going to be going to talk about this tomorrow when we talk about the death rebirth process. You know, often the question is, well, you know, we talked briefly about this projecting action, that one imprint ripens at the time of death to determine the next life. And they will say, the question is, well, what determines which imprint ripens? And there are a number of factors, but if we keep it simple, we can say that the one is the one that is most heavy. And so often then we have this sort of analogy of balance scales. Like if we do a lot of heavy negative things in our life and not so many good things, sort of the balance is like this, meaning one of those is going to ripen. Whereas if we do a lot of good things in life, the balance is the other way, one of those will ripen. So yes, they do have that effect, but simply doing some good actions is not going to be able to wipe out all the negative imprints. But it will have, of course, a very positive impact.
Thank you.
this didn't come up in discussion, but it just did now. Like, I was just looking at the power of remedy.
And, sure.
You know, with the power of remedy, let's say, and this might just be nitpicking, but let's say, you know, you did something to somebody to whom you can't remedy that action. You can't apologize. You can't, like, what... Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. I think I mentioned it briefly earlier, is that if we can't do the direct positive opposite, maybe that person's no longer around, they maybe passed away or whatever reason, then an effective practical remedy is to do any positive action with a motivation of wishing to overcome that negative behavior, because that sort of directs it in that way. And of course, if it involved like maybe harming someone, but maybe that person's not around or they've passed away, then a positive opposite would be to benefit. And if you can't benefit them, then help other people with that motivation is very effective. Yeah.
There are some deaths caused by accidents.
Some what, sorry?
Some accidents, not necessarily related to karma, right? Like the airplane exploded and...
Oh, okay. So,
people die at the same time. Not all of them are a result of the karma.
So, of course, there's two things here. There's the physical world of cause and effect, which, of course, is not karma. But then there's our experience of that, which is our karma. So, you know, the physical world of cause and effect that we see operating is not karma. But how we experience the world, of course, is the environmental effect. Is that the question?
How do you explain the people, the passenger die in an accident, like an airplane accident?
In the wrong place at the wrong time. Yes, it is. So remember, everything is produced through causes and conditions. So even if we have imprints to experience a certain result, if the conditions are not there, we won't experience the result. Or if we don't have the imprints to experience that result and the conditions are there, we won't experience the result. But if we have the imprint plus the conditions are there, we will experience the result.
300 people all have the same imprint.
Same, no. We all have negative imprints. We've inherited billions of them from previous lives. Yeah. See, one of the difficulties with this principle is sometimes people look at it with the assumption that we're born with a clean slate, that we're like tabula rasa when we're born. This, of course, then won't make sense, will it? But, you know, as we saw, that the mind is a continuum, and so this is our life. When we begin this life, we've inherited billions of imprints. What they are, we don't know. And so therefore, and of course in this life, then we add lots more imprints. And then at the end of this life, whatever imprints haven't ripened carry forward. So therefore, if we find ourselves in a situation, in a plane crash, we're probably going to die. That's because the conditions have come together. So we need causes and conditions for the experience.
It's possible someone on the airplane doesn't have the imprint, but because the airplane crashed today...
Well, maybe they'll survive then. Then they're the miraculous survivor. You know, sometimes we see this, no? Someone miraculously surviving. So here's interesting. Here's interesting. When someone's enlightened, then remember, there is no fixed objective reality. So if someone is enlightened and we see that the enlightened person in their body, there is some physical ailment, are they suffering? If they're enlightened, no. Like a story that just came to mind was within the FPMT, there was, not an FPMT, but in the Gluk, Kirti Senshi Rinpoche, who was living in Dharamsala, quite a high lama. And he was on tour at the time in Israel. And he had some stomach sort of problems. So he went to the hospital. And the doctors there diagnosed advanced stomach cancer. According to the doctors, he should have been in excruciating pain. They wanted to give him morphine. But through his translator, he said, I have no pain. I have no suffering. So, you know, again, if an enlightened person were to break their leg, we go, oh, God, they're suffering. But as we're going to see, suffering, pain is sensation. Suffering comes from aversion to pain. Aversion comes because we're grasping onto self. If we have no grasping onto self, it's sensation. Of course, it's intense sensation. So Curtis Tenzin Rinpoche probably felt intense sensations and saw that his digestion wasn't working very well, so he went to the hospital. But was he suffering? Well, if he was enlightened or highly realized, no, it's just sensation. So we have to understand that when we look at these ideas as well.
Morally know that that's not right, but if that person at that moment didn't see it as bad, maybe that imprint is not as like karmically
heavy.
Strong,
yeah, exactly. We covered that earlier in the I think we covered that point earlier. One of the things was one of the heavy makes it heavy is doing a negative action knowing it's harmful versus not knowing or being ignorant. Of course, it's still a harmful action, but the imprint is. Big difference, yes, exactly, of course. Okay, let's now then move on to this afternoon's topics. So, again, recapping, we've now just finished the how to make our life meaningful at the level of a person of small capacity. That is, we are simply striving for a good future. And we can develop the aspiration for a good future by reflecting on death and understanding that we don't really want suffering in the future. And therefore, how can we strive for that good future is we can really turn to refuge from suffering to the Buddha Dharma Sangha, the three jewels. And particularly there, the actual refuge, of course, is the Dharma. And the Dharma that we can take refuge in here is the understanding of karma, that if we engage in harmful actions, we will have suffering. If we engage in virtuous actions, we will have happiness. And from that, then, we would adopt an ethical lifestyle. We would abandon the 10 non-virtues. We would engage in the 10 virtuous actions. And then we would also engage in those four opponent powers to purify any negative imprints that we have because we don't want to experience the result of suffering. So therefore, from this presentation then of karma, the outcome of that is then we would adopt an ethical lifestyle and also purify any negative behavior with the four opponent powers. And that would ensure a good future life. And so if we want to maintain this precious human life, then that's what we need to do. If we abandon harming others, engage in the virtuous actions, purify negative actions, we're going to go a long way towards ensuring we have a precious human life again in future lives. And of course, if we don't believe in rebirth, then I think if we adopt an ethical lifestyle now, and abandon harm, purify negativities, engage in virtue, I think we'll have a meaningful life anyway. So it's a win-win situation. But here, we're still stuck in samsara. So even though we may adopt ethical lifestyle and purify negativities and have a reasonable level of good existence, we're still in samsara. We're still subject to that cycle. So then someone of medium capacity is someone who's then striving for the next higher goal, the goal of liberation from samsara altogether. So if we look at the start of that in the outline here, that's on page 15, near the top here. It says, in the training, the mind for the person of medium capacity, persons of medium capacity develop disenchantment with all of cyclic existence. So cyclic existence, of course, is the English translation of samsara. And then make their goal their own liberation from cyclic existence. They then enter the path of the three trainings, the method for attaining liberation. So again, the first thing we need to do here is first develop the aspiration for liberation. Then, when we have the aspiration for liberation, then we need to practice, engage in the practices that enable us to achieve that. And here mentioned are the three higher trainings. Remember, that's a summary of this Noble Eightfold Path, these eight practices.
I'm sorry, but before we leave small capacity,
sure.
I just have one other question.
Sure.
On the attributes of the fruitions and the causes, number 7 about being male, is that something... is that of another time and place?
Oh, where are we looking?
Oh, sorry, back to reflecting on karma and its effect.
Yeah, sure. Oh, the attributes of the efficients, yeah. So, yeah. So here it's talking about extra qualities that are helpful in the spiritual path. And again, yes, exactly what you said is at that time, and we're going back to the time of the Buddha, basically most of those cultures were patriarchal cultures. And so if you were female, woman in those cultures, you really didn't have much opportunity.
Right.
So in those times, then yes, it would be advantageous to be male. But actually, I think it's opposite now. It's opposite. In fact, in all the years I've been teaching now, in the last 8 years, particularly in Dharamsala, Tishita, where we get people from all over the world, they keep statistics of participants. And it's amazing, even there and other places I go, it seems to be always the same proportion. 60% women, 40% men. Always. Every year it's the same statistic. So it seems like women have the advantage now. Yeah, so, I mean, in terms of the spiritual path itself, of course, it is completely equal. But, again, this was in a time where actually it was disadvantageous to be a female. But of course, now it's the op. In fact, it's the op. So maybe now they should change it to women.
Yeah, it's not the op.
Fine. But it seems like that certainly interest and engaging in the spiritual, I mean, the statistics are 60-40 always, wherever I go. So it seems like many more women are interested than men. So I think... women are a little bit more advanced than men, maybe.
I feel like they start from a forward T. I mean, it's like kindness and compassion that we kind of associate with women. I feel like they start from a forward T from us, you know?
But remember, that's possibly true as well. But I think also in our modern societies, although that's changing a lot now, but certainly 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, you know, the male role in society was the breadwinner, you know, the career person, and so therefore that sort of had that blinkered vision where I think women haven't had that stereotype so much, although now that's changing. So they've been more free to then sort of do really what they want, whereas men sort of are expected to do that. I think that's one reason, perhaps. I mean, there are probably many reasons.
Just to comment that we're 50-50 in here.
Bam. Nowadays, monks are still treated higher status than nuns.
Yes, in those traditions, yes, that because that's the change. that's the culture in those traditions, in those Asian traditions. Yeah.
Can we change that? Or
I don't know.
We need a revolution.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nuns
Tibetan Buddhist nuns in India now can take the Geshe.
Yeah, yeah.
That's only been in the last couple of years.
Yeah, there's a lot of change happening. Yeah, there's a lot of change happening. Yeah.
I mean, maybe trying to take a specific gender role out of it. Is there something implied in this that if you have a child and a family, that that's kind of an obstacle to a spiritual life, and you get so involved with taking care of that?
We're going to look a little bit at that coming up in this end of this section. But, you know, here, particularly in the Lam Rim, we're talking about the Mahayana, where we're not talking about only personal liberation. We're talking about helping others as well. So actually, sometimes it can be very advantageous to have a family because, you know, there are people there that really you can benefit then and so forth. So in the terms of the Mahayana, then... In fact, it can be advantageous to have that. Having said that, of course, then we need, and that's going to be coming up a little bit later, is that, of course, we need some time and space for ourselves for meditation and developing ourselves. So whether we are having a family or not, we need to have a little bit that ability to have a little bit of space. But then, of course... there's this balance between inner development and outward expression. So, you know, we shouldn't think that spiritual path means we need to sit in a cave the rest of our life, you know. So we need that balance, but we need that balance. So, again, whether or not we have a family, I think, is not so important.
Well, I mean, I do see in the modern world where it's like increasingly both parents are working just to help keep the thing together. And so, and again, in that sense, there's no time... You know, it just kind of comes down to that. And I don't know about the ancient world, but it makes me wonder about the situation.
Yeah, but again, as I already, I think, briefly mentioned, yes, that's true that often both people are working, but sometimes it's because they want to make more money because they need a bigger house, a bigger car, better holidays. Then if that's our goal, then, of course, it's not going to work. I mean, if we're really working 60, 70, 80 hours a week, so that we can earn a little bit more money to have a bigger car and bigger house that we have no time to enjoy anyway, then, you know, what's the point? What's the point, you know? Of course, most of us need to have some job to earn enough money to have a roof over our head and that. So, again, it's all to do with priorities. And it's all, and the thing that, as we saw with the Steve Jobs quote, the key, one of the keys here is to reflect on precious human life and death. If we really internalize that, we're going to see how a lot of this effort we put in to these sorts of things is really just meaningless. In fact, there's a very famous thing on the internet about the top five regrets of dying people that was put together by an Australian lady doing the hospice movement over many years, interviewing people. And she said, and this was over some years, so often in a period where it was the man who was the career person and the woman not so much, she said every single male had the same top regret. Working too hard, not spending enough time with family, and that was their top regret. Everyone.
Wow.
So maybe we don't want to have that regret. Okay, so let's continue on here. So we are in the medium capacity. So again, here we are, initially we have to develop the aspiration for liberation. And that is mentioned here. It says, if we go down a little bit further, there's the mental training. It says, from beginningless time, you have been conditioned to believe that the wonders of cyclic existence are sources of happiness and that you have habitually projected upon them a false image of beauty. But if, as a remedy, you train yourself to meditate on suffering, and of course suffering here means dukkha, unsatisfactory nature of samsara, and unpleasantness, you will put an end to these wrong ideas. Hence, it is vitally important to meditate on the faults of cyclic existence. So here we are to develop this aspiration to liberation. We need to see how the disadvantages or the unsatisfactory nature of cyclic existence of samsara. Otherwise, of course, we're going to continue to look for happiness in the world in front of us. And then to identify, it says now here, identifying the mind intent on liberation, it says, liberation means freedom from bondage, and what binds you to cyclic existence is karma and the afflictions. So remember the second noble truth, that the source of suffering or dukkha is our mental afflictions and our actions or karma that come from those mental afflictions. Under their power, the aggregates are reborn. And I'm going to talk a lot about, I'm going to explain these aggregates in some detail very shortly. Since this is the nature of bondage, freedom from rebirth impelled by karma and the afflictions is liberation. And the desire to obtain that freedom is the mind intent on liberation. So here, what they've translated as mind intent on liberation is what is normally translated as renunciation. So again, renunciation is not a very good translation. But it sort of was used early on and it sort of stuck. So therefore, when you see this word renunciation in these texts or Buddhist texts, again, it's simply the mind intent on liberation, the mind aspiring to liberation from samsara.
I think we associate renunciation with giving up something. The best definition I've heard is giving up all hope of finding lasting peace or satisfaction within samsara.
Yeah, so that's true. So renunciation is in fact, this aspiration is sort of two steps. One is to, as you said, is to let go of attachment to happiness here. So that's renunciation. Renunciation is talking about the first step, is forget about finding happiness out there. Let go of attachment to the eight worldly concerns. So that's renunciation. But of course, this is more than that. It's not going there, but looking here, looking within ourselves, in our own mind, for liberation. So there's sort of two steps in the process of this mind intent on liberation. Renunciation, sort of talking a little bit about the first part of that, is to give up looking for genuine happiness out there. But then, of course, the next step then is to look within ourselves for liberation from suffering. And to develop this aspiration, of course, then first, as it says here, we need to understand the unsatisfactory nature of samsara and why it's like that. So we need to reflect on these first two, four of the four noble truths, the truth of suffering or dukkha, and then the cause of that. Why is it like that? Then, from understanding those two, we can understand that it's possible to break free, and then we can develop the aspiration for that. And then, of course, engage in these three higher trainings to actually achieve that result. So that's what we're going to look at now. Again, so there's two parts here. There's first is the reflections or practices to help us to develop this aspiration, this mind intent on liberation. And here there are two reflections. The first one here is reflection on suffering and its origin. And then if we go down to page 18, the second one, B, in the middle, is reflection from the viewpoint of the 12 dependent arisings. So the 12 dependent arisings are these 12 diagrams here in this wheel of life, which is another way of understanding, similar to the two noble truths, first two noble truths, of how we are stuck in this cycle of samsara. So we can use both of those to appreciate how we are stuck in samsara under the power of our mental afflictions and actions. So we're going to look at those 12 links later, but now we're going to look at the first approach, and that is to look at the faults of cyclic existence in terms of the truth, the first two noble truths, the truth of dukkha, suffering, and the cause of that, the mental afflictions. So that's where we are now. And here it talks first about reflection on the universal suffering of cyclic existence. So here we have three presentations talking about the nature of samsara from slightly different perspectives. So here we first see a presentation called the eight types of suffering, and then over on the next page, the six types of suffering, and then a bit further down, the three types of suffering. So, again, what I'd like to do is begin with the three types of suffering, which is what we already looked at earlier in the Four Noble Truths. So, of course, here, suffering, the three types of suffering, the word suffering is dukkha. So, dukkha is the Buddha's diagnosis for our current condition. So what we are to do, of course, is to understand what condition we find ourselves in. Because if we don't understand we're in this unsatisfactory state, then we're never going to entertain the possibility of transcending it. The same as with the analogy. If we don't realize that we may be sick, we're never going to take any steps to think about maybe curing ourselves. We're going to think simply that's normal, and we're going to continue in our life in that sick state thinking, well, that's it, you know, I just have to put up with it. Whereas here, we are to really appreciate clearly that we're in this unsatisfactory state, where it's coming from, and the fact that we can actually overcome it. So the first step is to understand dukkha. So this is the three types of suffering, or three types of dukkha. And so here, they're listed in a slightly different order than we did before. So before we had the dukkha of suffering. Which is our unpleasant experiences. And so this is translated here as the suffering of pain. Then we have the dukkha of change, the same name here. And of course, this is referring to our pleasant experiences. And as we saw earlier, this is what we normally identify as happiness. And this is what we normally identify as suffering, the unpleasant experiences. So therefore, we end up with a lot of aversion to this, and we end up with a lot of attachment to this. But what we are to understand here is that these pleasant experiences are never going to fulfill us. They're never going to fully satisfy us. Because as the name suggests, change, they are simply temporary, transient experiences. They're unreliable because we need certain stimulus to have them, and also they're not in the nature of happiness. Because if these pleasant experiences were in the nature of happiness, the more that we would engage in them, the more happy we should become. But we can understand that if we overindulge in these pleasant experiences, they often then turn into suffering itself. So they are simply relative experiences. So we are to understand this to stop having craving and attachment for them, and stop the hoping that these pleasant experiences are going to satisfy us and fulfill us. But to really appreciate the state we find ourselves in, we need to really understand the third one. The all-pervasive dukkha, which is translated here as suffering of conditionality. So remember, this all-pervasive suffering is the fact that there's always a potential for suffering to arise because our mind is contaminated by the mental afflictions. And in this section here, the suffering of conditionality, it says in the last sentence there, therefore, since the suffering of conditionality pervades all suffering and is the root of the other two types of suffering, meditate on it in order to become disenchanted with it. In the suffering of conditionality, at the bottom of page 16, the last sentence in the quotes. So, again, if we really want to develop this aspiration for liberation, we really need to, at the deepest level, appreciate this, that we really are stuck, that we're stuck because our mind is contaminated by the mental afflictions. And if we can appreciate that, and then we reflect on the mental afflictions, which is the next section, and understand that these mental afflictions are coming from ignorance, and that this ignorance is actually something we can get rid of, we can then appreciate we can overcome this. Then we can develop the aspiration for liberation, because we have understood this sequence. So if we can really appreciate this, understand this, and then go on to understand the mental afflictions, we can really then develop the aspiration for liberation.
So what's the point of breaking down the three? I always have this question. If that one's all pervasive and it is the root of the other two, why do we even list the other two?
Just to remember dukkha, the first noble truth, the Buddha said dukkha is to be known. So we are to understand our current condition.
At different levels.
So what is our current human condition? Our current human condition is that sometimes we have unpleasant suffering experiences.
Okay.
Generally, we sort of know that, and that that's not very satisfactory.
Okay.
So this one is not too difficult to know.
Yeah.
But then the Buddha said, you need to know this as well.
Mm.
Of course, we have pleasant experiences, but we believe and grasp in them, hoping that they're going to give us happiness.
Okay.
The Buddha said, we don't know them then.
Uh-huh.
We think they're happiness when they're not.
Yeah.
So to know them is to know this,
uh-huh,
that our pleasant experiences are simply temporary, transient experiences.
Right.
We're not saying that somehow we shouldn't like pleasant experiences, we shouldn't engage in them. We're just talking about knowing them for what they are.
Okay.
Now we don't know them.
Right.
We hope that they're going to make us happy and we grasp at them.
Right.
And because of that, we have a lot of suffering, unnecessarily.
Okay.
So part of... And so, you know, therefore we look for happiness here, but the Buddha said, you're not going to find happiness there.
Mm-hmm.
At best, you'll have some temporary pleasant experience, at best. At worst, you're going to induce a lot of unnecessary suffering. So you need to know this.
Mm-hmm.
And many spiritual traditions point there.
Right.
Many spiritual traditions say it's our desire, our attachment, that's the root of evil.
Okay.
True. But from a Buddhist perspective, there's something deeper going on.
Mm.
And that is this. And that is, at the deepest level, that our condition is that we're stuck, because our mind is contaminated by the mental afflictions.
To begin with. It's like,
so this is the underlying nature of our existence.
That makes us think we're going to find happiness and pleasant experiences.
Well, that's one of the reasons, yeah.
Okay.
And, but if we know this,
then
of course we're never going to chase after happiness there.
Okay.
Because we'll know that it's pointless.
Yeah.
It's never going to work. But again, we're not saying that according to Buddhism it's bad or wrong to enjoy pleasant experiences. No,
mm-hmm,
enjoy them.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoy them.
Mm-hmm.
But what Buddhism is saying is if you're pinning your hopes for genuine happiness here, you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
You're in trouble. You're going to just induce a lot of unnecessary suffering.
Yeah. I don't mean to belabor this.
Sure.
I'm always thinking of how to explain these concepts to children, right, mm-hmm, running the family camps here. So... From a child.
Well, this you probably wouldn't want to. But this, I think you could introduce in a skillful way.
Those two, but that's why I'm asking about the third one. Like, how could you break that down so a child could get that?
I mean, you could. I mean, you could. No, you could say. I mean, you could say. You know, to the child, as long as you get angry and jealous and stuff,
yeah.
then it's going to be difficult to have peace of mind.
Uh huh. Okay.
Yeah, as long as you know, have these sort of mental states of jealousy and anger and craving,
right.
you're never going to have peace
so
of mind.
Our ultimate goal is to work with those.
So, I mean, right. you could present to children that this genuine happiness is just peace of mind, you know, peace of mind. And as long as their mind is agitated by these things,
yeah.
then they're never going to have that.
Right.
Maybe you could present it something like that.
Thank you.
Okay. So then if we go back to the eight types of suffering, this is a presentation that also often comes, particularly the first four, the suffering of birth, old age or aging, sickness and death. So this, of course, is the cycle that we are constantly going through, birth, aging, sickness and death. So I think they are fairly straightforward. Then we have another three that are also very dominant in our human life. And the first one is the suffering of encountering what is unpleasant. So again, no matter how hard we try, we always seem to encounter unpleasant things. And then also, over the page, then no matter how hard we try also to hold on to pleasant things, we are eventually separated from them. And that induces a lot of suffering. Suffering of being separated from the pleasant. And together with that, of course, then often we suffer a lot if we don't get what we want. So these three are also very common. This encountering unpleasant things, of losing pleasant things and not getting what we want. So I think these are also fairly obvious, and these are really also pointing to how we have attachment to the pleasant and we have aversion to the unpleasant. And that's something I'm going to talk more about tomorrow, is in fact a lot of our suffering is self-induced because of aversion. Yes, it's true, we meet with unpleasant situations and they create some discomfort. But often a huge percentage of our suffering is self-induced, way above what's actually there. And that is through this aversion of not wanting the unpleasant situation. And again, a lot of the suffering we experience is through attachment to the pleasant. And then either not getting it or being worried about losing it. So these two things of attachment aversion are some of the main topics for tomorrow.
As part of that discussion, will you talk about healthy ways to deal with anger?
Yes. Yes. We will. Hopefully some practical advice. And within Buddhism, there are, of course, like in dealing with these mental afflictions, we have a multi-perspective approach, meaning we can work with these mental afflictions from a number of different perspectives. But what they are, we'll start to look at tomorrow. And then the last of the eight, it says the suffering of the five appropriated aggregates. So what does that mean? Let's have a look at the sentence there in the quote. It says, it is in the nature of the five aggregates appropriated by karma and affliction to be. And so here, the five appropriated aggregates, and I'm going to talk about them in detail now. Of course, the five aggregates, simplified, is simply the body and the mind. So the body and mind we have now is coming from our mental afflictions and actions. You know, that then this life is being projected, and then this body and mind we have now is under the influence of our mental afflictions and actions. And so therefore, because of that, then this body and mind we have now is a vessel for future suffering. It's a vessel for suffering based on what is presently existing. And it's a vessel for the suffering of pain, the first one. Vessel for the suffering of change, and a vessel for the suffering of conditionality, or pervasive. So let's now have a look then what we mean by these five aggregates, because this presentation of the five aggregates is talked about in many different areas in Buddhism. It's talked about here in terms of this cycle of samsara. It's talked about in terms of later in the Vipassana practice, in many areas. So I think it's very helpful to know what we mean by these five aggregates. So the five aggregates, the word aggregate in Sanskrit is skanda. And skanda literally means a heap. A heap. So the five aggregates here can be a presentation, a way of dividing up all functional phenomena. But more often, in many areas in Buddhism, it's used as a presentation of a way of dividing up a person into the person's parts. So let's have a look at the five aggregates and how they relate to the aspects of the person. The form aggregate, or in Sanskrit, rupa, is talking about the body. When we use the five aggregates as a presentation of the aspects of a person. If we're talking about the five aggregates as a presentation of all functional phenomena, then the form aggregate, of course, is all physical phenomena. All matter and energy would be here. But here we're talking about it primarily in terms of the basis of the person, so then the form aggregate is simply the body. Then, of course, the other part of the person is the mind. And remember, we briefly looked at the first afternoon. One way of dividing up the mind was into this main mind and mental factors. And the main mind was, again, that's part of the mind or aspect of the mind that is simply engaging in the entity of the object itself, the raw experience of the object, whereas the mental factors were all the various factors that would determine what type of experience we have of that object. And remembering the mental factors here, I mentioned a few of the 51 that are listed. And within this list of 51, there are two that I said were very, well, many of them are important, of course, but two get special attention. One that gets special attention is the mental factor of feeling. And so that actually is taken out and made separate. So that's the second aggregate. Which in Sanskrit is vedana. So remember, feeling, or vedana, is the mental factor that experiences things as either being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And this gets special attention because it's often on the basis of our pleasant and unpleasant experiences that we develop attachment, aversion, and have a lot of suffering. So it's our reacting to feelings, it's our reaction to pleasant, unpleasant experiences that generates a lot of suffering. So that's why it gets special attention. So it's taken out of this list of 51 and put separately. Likewise, there is another mental factor here called discrimination. And in Sanskrit, this is samjna. And discrimination was the mental factor that enables us to clearly distinguish one phenomena from another. So, of course, if our discrimination is not working well, if we can't discriminate things correctly, then, of course, we end up with a lot of problems. So it also is taken out and made separate for that reason. Then the fourth aggregate is simply all these other mental factors, 49 of them, in a group. And often this is translated into English as something like compositional factors. The Sanskrit word here is samskara. And the reason it's called compositional factors is depending on which of these factors are present in our experience, they are literally composing what our future is going to look like. Because if we, for example, have anger present, this is composing not a very good future if we get angry and create a lot of negativity. Any of you who've done the Goenka Vipassana, Goenkaji uses this word samskaras a lot, and he calls it the reactive mind. So remember in this 51... 26 were mental afflictions, so yes, our mind is quite reactive. So that's why they're called compositional factors, because depending on which of these factors are present in our experiences, they are going to compose what our future is going to look like in terms of our current behavior.
Do we have control over those or no?
We'd like to have control over them. Yeah.
Those, that whole list of 49 or 50,
yeah,
those are present. Some of them are present in mental yeah. moments and some aren't.
Yeah, there are some which are called omnipresent, which are always present, like these ones, in every single experience. But mental factors such as anger and jealousy and so forth are not always present, of course. So some are always present and others sometimes yes, sometimes no. Like the 26 mental afflictions, maybe yes, maybe no. But things like this is always present. So these three together is then the mental factors. So then the fifth aggregate, which is consciousness, in Sanskrit, vijnana, is then the main mind. So then these four aggregates together, the last four is the mind. So the first, the form aggregate is the body. These four together is the mind. Why do we have this presentation of the five aggregates? Why don't we just talk about body and mind? So again, I think one of the reasons is to highlight that feeling and discrimination, these two mental factors, we need to pay attention to. They really bring us into a lot of trouble. And also to understand that the person is made up of many different things, many different parts. It's not a singular thing. That's why, you know, the Buddha said the person is made up of the five skandhas, the five heaps of things. So there's not a singular... So this is also a teaching that to help us to understand the person is not a singular solid thing. It's actually just a collection of many things. So this is also why we have the presentation on the five aggregates, to help us to understand this. So this is the five aggregates, which comes up a lot in Buddhist teachings. Often it's used as a presentation of the basis of a person, but it can also be a presentation to describe all functioning phenomena. And when it's in that case, then of course the form aggregate is simply all physical phenomena, and the other four are all mental phenomena. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about five aggregates. Any questions on that before we move on? Yes.
I've been struggling with this, the reflections on the eight types of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Where it says, if you do not cultivate a genuine sense of disenchantment, this cyclic existence,
yeah,
you will have no chance to develop a genuine mind intent on liberation. I understand that. If
right.
I don't buy into reincarnation and I don't practice this, I'm not going to achieve that. But then it says, and there is no way for you to develop great compassion for living beings wandering through cyclic existence.
Right.
And I...
Right, okay, yeah.
The disenfranchisement or the disenchantment, I have a really hard time. When I heard about the reincarnation, I was like, woohoo! But that's because, like, the suffering has, in my life, yielded kindness. Like it's
sure.
Like it's softened.
Sure.
And like, how do you become disenchanted with something that has improved you?
Because even though often suffering leads to, as is mentioned here, in fact, I think it comes up, it's somewhere in the text here, it talks about five qualities of suffering. I think it's coming up, it's coming soon actually. Which means there are five ways in which we can learn from suffering. But that doesn't mean we need to continue to suffer to develop as a person. So if we're having suffering or had suffering, we can learn from that by developing compassion for ourselves and others. But actually, if we're in the middle of suffering, it's going to be difficult to develop our mind and help others, isn't it? I mean, if we're in heavy depression, how are we going to help others?
Right, but I'm saying it's lifted me out of...
Exactly, exactly. So now we can benefit from that and move forward and go beyond suffering so that we can be in a very good condition to help others.
Right, but it feels like they're almost saying I have to. Like, I can't develop compassion for others if I don't disavow it.
Disavow...
If I don't become disenchanted with yeah. it.
What is it saying? It's becoming disenchanted with what?
This genuine sense of disenchantment with the cyclic existence.
Exactly. So what's cyclic existence? What is cyclic existence?
Isn't that the reincarnation?
Yeah. So cyclic existence is the continuous cycle of birth under the power of mental afflictions and karma. Do we want to do that? Do we want to be continually reborn with mental afflictions and suffering?
I don't know. It's been a good trip.
We're having a good trip, relatively speaking, right now.
Right. I get that. But like, I guess the issue is, since I'm not yet to reincarnation, since I'm kind of looking at it as a linear still perspective.
Right.
That I have a hard time disavowing what brought me here because I feel then it's hopeful that it could bring others to a better place.
So, but what we're talking about here is developing the aspiration to break free of this so that we ourselves can stop suffering, and more importantly in the Mahayana, so that we can more effectively help others. That's why we don't... Do we really want to still continue in the cycle of suffering? Or do we want to now learn from our suffering and go beyond suffering so we can help others go beyond suffering? Which do we prefer?
Well, I
want to
help others, but I feel like there's so much still to learn.
Correct. And if we're caught up in heavy suffering, can we learn a lot when we're in that condition? Not really.
Not in the condition.
None. That's right. So that's what disenchantment means. It means to wish to be free of that so we can learn more, we can be liberated from suffering, and more importantly, then we can more effectively help others to be free of suffering. That's what why we're becoming disenchanted. Because now we struggle to improve ourselves because often we're caught in the middle of heavy suffering. And we also struggle to help others because our mental afflictions and suffering gets in the way of helping others. That's why we need to become disenchanted, so that we can better learn, liberate, and help others better.
Okay, so I have to believe that there's better, and that's where I have to work on that.
No, it's not a matter of believing. We can check this through our own experience.
But the removal of suffering is like a leap for my mind.
That's why we need to do these reflections. If someone just blindly tells you you can be liberated from suffering, then it would be foolish just to blindly believe that. That's why we're doing these reflections here that we're talking about right now, particularly what's coming, is what is, when we say suffering, what do we mean? What is that? And clearly identify that. That was the three types we looked at. And then where is that coming from? And then that's what we're going to look at tomorrow, is where is that coming from? Not believing anything, looking.
Okay.
And understanding. And if we can understand that actually it's coming from our mental afflictions, and then we can look at our mental afflictions and go, well, where is our mental afflictions coming from? And then through understanding, not belief, through understanding, we can understand they're coming from our distorted view of reality. And we're going to look at that tomorrow. And then we can go, well, okay, can I do something about that distorted view or not? Because if I can't, I'm stuck. That's it. Finished. End of story. But if I can, then I can overcome my mental afflictions and I can overcome my suffering. And it's on the basis of that reflection, then we go, oh, actually, I can be liberated. Let's do that. That's how to develop the liberation, not because someone says you should do it. This is what we need to do. We need to reflect on the process, and we're going to do that through this first two noble truths and these 12 links. Mm-hmm. After that, we're going to look at these two processes to understand logically why we're in this state and can we do something about it. Then when we realize we can do something about it, then and only then would we be able to develop a genuine wish for liberation. Because if we don't believe, we don't know where it's coming from, and we don't believe we can overcome it, then how are we going to develop a wish for liberation? It's not going to work, is it?
Yeah, I believe we can overcome it. I just feel like my stumbling block is the world seems almost steady state in its pain and suffering. So if people are achieving this, why aren't we seeing the impact?
I think we are seeing that now. I think we are in this era now seeing a lot more people moving into those areas. I think it's just sort of starting to happen a little bit. But I really believe that there is this sort of groundswell. Maybe they haven't achieved liberation, but I think there is now this groundswell of starting to maybe appreciate that the source of suffering and happiness is not really out there. It's maybe in here. I mean, this is the starting point, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's, I think, happening.
Yeah, no, because all these vehicles and ways of thinking I love, but it's just that whole thought of, you know, giving up what's gotten me to appreciate those forms.
So what we're saying is that yes, often, in fact, you're right, often people don't enter into any sort of meaningful spiritual life unless they've had some heavy suffering. Because if things are going too well, people just sort of float along and everything's cool, you know, no problem. And then they don't do anything with their life.
Right.
And that often happens. It's only when we're faced with some quite often traumatic, you know, we lose a partner, we have a serious illness, we lose our job, midlife crisis, all of these things. It's only often, not always, but often it's on the face of some difficult situation that forces us to think about our life. And, you know, generally in a group like this, if I were to ask how many people came into this way of thinking through that, I'd say more than 50% would put their hand up. I mean, I won't ask, but my experience is that many of the people I talk to only come in to looking at these sorts of things because they've had some heavy problem in their life. Not always. Some people just through their own thinking get that way, but often it's the case. But that doesn't mean we need to continue to have heavy problems in our life. Because if we have too many heavy problems in our life, we're not going to be able to implement these ideas very well.
You've given
hope.
Yeah. Kind of a small thing, maybe, but so when you were going through the five aggregates, the first three were like always constant.
Well, always, always constant.
Constant.
Well, they're always present in every experience.
Right. Well, okay. So I don't.
And so is this, of course.
That was the thing that threw me up. Like, so is it implying that consciousness is or is not always there?
Yeah, it's always there. Yeah. Of course.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. The body's there. The mind's always there. Some of these mental factors are not always there. Some of them are dormant. Fortunately, a lot of the time. Otherwise, we'd be crazy. No, I wasn't going to go into that detail because this is a whole big topic, you know, that I mentioned, this low rig. We won't go there.
Can I just mention that one of them is volition or intention?
Yeah, intention, yeah, that's right. So intention, yes, volition or intention is one of the five omnipresent mental factors. Yes, that's correct.
Now, I don't know, is low rig a detailed program for eliminating the mental afflictions, for identifying them as mental factors and eliminating? What is low rig?
Low rig is minds and awarenesses, so it covers more than this. I mean, it talks about also ways of knowing. It talks about wrong consciousness and, you know, all of this sort of thing. So there's quite a lot to it.
Is it a practice to...
Practice? No, it's more about, like, Buddhist psychology.
Okay.
So it's not really... It's not talking about how to deal with anger or attachment or anything. It's just simply identifying the various aspects of experience. That's all.
Okay.
So if you were looking for something about how to deal with... Of course, this clear information about the mind and consciousness is a good starting point because we appreciate how our mind is functioning or how it's dysfunctional. So that's a good starting point.
You might explain a little bit of compositional factors.
Yeah, so again, the compositional factors here are the other 49 mental factors. And the reason they're called compositional factors is depending on which ones are present, they are going to, of course, be affecting our behaviour or driving our behaviour. And therefore, that's composing what our future experiences is going to look like. So again, in the Goenka Vipassana, often Goenkaji calls this samskaras the reactive mind, because often a lot of the factors present in our experiences are our reactive mind, our mental afflictions. Okay. So that is the 8 types of suffering. And then very briefly, the 6 types of suffering here. And this is talking a lot more about the whole cycling within samsara. So the first one, you know, the fault of uncertainty, meaning that, you know, the uncertainty of our relationships with others. You know, sometimes people can be our friend and then they can become our enemy, or we have different relationships with people all the time. And then the fault of insatiability, meaning that our pleasures will never fully satisfy us. So we'll always be wanting, craving more and more and more. And then the fault of casting off bodies repeatedly, meaning we continually taking rebirth, which is similar to the fault of repeated rebirth. And then repeatedly descending from high and low, meaning that we, within a life, we may go from a very high good status to a low suffering status, or within the six realms of existence we can go up to pleasurable, down to suffering, we all over the place. And then the last one, the fault of having no companions, is talking about the fact, of course, that we have to go through the death and rebirth processes by ourselves alone. So this is talking a little bit more about the whole cycling within samsara, the six types of suffering. So I think most of those are fairly obvious. So I didn't really want to mention anything more about those. I want to talk a little bit about the last section here at the bottom of page 16 or 17, where it talks about reflection on specific sufferings. So here again, we'll use our Wheel of Life chart. So in the earlier section, when we talked about the small capacity person, we briefly looked at what's called the three lower realms, these three realms of the preta, animal, and narak, and how within these realms there tends to be a lot of physical suffering. But here in the person of medium capacity, we are trying to understand that all existences within samsara are unsatisfactory. So therefore here, you know, in the person of small capacity, they're striving for these high status, for animal, for a human, deva, asura type of future. But now in the medium capacity, we're trying to understand that even a human deva or asura type of existence is not satisfactory. And so we are to look at then these three types of existences here. And that's what this presentation is here in terms of the various sufferings that even in the human realm, and here the demigod is this asura realm, and then the deities is what is a translation of the deva realm. So I want to talk a little bit about these, particularly I'll give a bit of an overview of all these realms. And generally they're listed in this order because this order is generally is in terms of level of happiness versus level of suffering. So the higher up the list we go, as a generalization, less suffering, more happiness. But of course this is a generalization, and within each of these realms there can be large discrepancies, but as a generalization. And so we saw that these three what are called the unfortunate or lower realms, because here generally there's more suffering than happiness. These three realms are sometimes called the upper or fortunate realms because there's more happiness than suffering. So someone of small capacity would be simply looking for such a future existence. But then someone in medium capacity now is understanding that actually wherever we are here, we're still stuck in the cycle of samsara. And to understand the unsatisfactory nature of all of these types of existences, not just the ones with heavy physical suffering. And in here, when it talks about the deva or deity realm, it breaks it into two. It talks about here in the top of page 17, the desire realm, and then a little bit lower it talks about the form and formless realm. So I want to briefly mention that to understand what we're talking about here. So we can often talk about these six realms, but then also sometimes you'll hear a presentation of the three realms. you'll see presentation about what's called the desire realm, the form realm, and the formless realm. Desire realm is where we are now. This is the desire realm for us, of course, because desire realm here means that it's a realm that is dominated by craving and attachment, particularly to the sense objects. And so often, then, this desire realm, when we talk about these six types of existences here, they're often referring to the desire realm. That all of these six types of existences are within this realm of existence. But then we have these higher planes of existence. In the form realm, we transcend desire. We go beyond attachment. I mean, we don't eliminate it, but we transcend it. We end up in a more subtle level of existence called the form realm. And then we can even transcend this subtle existence called the form realm and enter into the formless realm. How do we do that? Is mentioned a little bit here in the text, so let's have a look at that. If we go down to the section at the bottom of page 17 here, it talks about how you accumulate karma. So if we have a look there, the quote under how you accumulate karma at the bottom of page 17 says, as long as you operate under the influence of a conception of a self, so this is this ignorance, you will accumulate karma that will impel you into cyclic existence. Once you have perceived reality, that is selflessness, you will not accumulate any new karma that can impel such rebirth. So to go beyond this cycle of rebirth, we need to get rid of this ignorance, this self-grasping. Because our self-grasping ignorance leads to the mental afflictions, leads to our actions, our karma, which will impel us in these various types of existences. But then it goes on to talk about, based on our different actions, what sorts of existence are propelled. So here it talks about accumulating karma for pleasant feelings. So then it says here, if your concern is mainly for the pleasures of this lifetime prior to death, you accumulate non-meritorious action, meaning that often we end up engaging in negative, harmful behavior. So if we engage in non-meritorious or non-virtuous actions, then we will end up down here. So we can talk about our actions. We can talk about non-meritorious, meritorious, so if we engage in non-meritorious or non-virtuous actions, then we're creating the cause to end up in one of these three realms. If we engage in meritorious or virtuous actions, then we will end up in one of these three realms. But then we also have, if we go over, at the bottom it says here, accumulating karma for gaining bliss in meditative concentration after you have rejected attachment to external sensual pleasures. So this is talking about invariable karma or unmoving karma. So, and we create this karma through our shamatha practice. If we develop concentration, then one of the qualities that we develop in concentration is bliss, a lot of bliss. So through doing this concentration practice, then we can create this, what's called invariable karma, which will create the cause for being reborn next time in the form realm. Because that concentration we're developing is going beyond desire or attachment. We're transcending it through our concentration. We haven't eliminated it, but we've gone beyond. So that concentration creates the condition to be reborn in the form realm. And there's a little technical point here, is that, remember the form realm, we talked about the four jhanas, the four levels of concentration, the four jhanas. The first three have got bliss associated with them. So if we develop those, then we're reborn in one of those first three levels. But then if we go beyond the bliss, then we can create karma to be reborn at this fourth level. But we can also develop these four samapattis, the highest levels of concentration. If we develop those, we can create this invariable karma to be reborn in this formless realm. So, therefore, we can talk about these three levels or planes of existence, as well as we can talk about the six realms here. So, then, when we talk about the six realms, and we talk about the deva realm, which is translated here as deity realm, then often this deva realm is just talking about this. But this word deva can refer to those types of beings in this, all three realms. So the deva here can include all of this. That's why it says in the text here that the deities or devas of the desire realm, the form realm, and formless realm.
As you ascend among the realms of the three realms, isn't it said that the lifespans get longer and longer?
Yeah.
Is that true also of the six realms?
Going down, yeah. Generally, it's said that here the lifespan gets... In fact, it's. I think in both directions it seems to... In the middle here, it's not so long, but going down, it seems to get longer, and going up, it gets longer, yes. Seems to be.
In the Mahayana tradition, what do we say happened to Buddha exactly? Was he reborn in another world system, or did he go to the formless realm?
So, how are we going for time? Yeah. Generally within the Theravada traditions, Prince Siddhartha was a sort of normal person, went through the training, became enlightened, taught, age 80, went into what's called Parinirvana. And within the Theravada tradition, I mentioned briefly the other day, then after you achieve that nirvana and this body finishes, you end up in what's called nirvana without a remainder, which is that you never ever again appear in the world. If you ask them what's there at that time, they say it's inexpressible. But definitely... that person will never ever again appear in the world.
Right.
Whereas the Mahayana would say that sounds a bit illogical. And so from a Mahayana perspective, and I think certainly in Tibetan Buddhism, Prince Siddhartha was already enlightened. That he just went through that to display how to do it for the benefit of others. And that... then that life of Prince Siddhartha and Shakyamuni Buddha was just one of many manifestations in the world to help others. So, therefore, on the basis of that understanding, then it could be that that same person who achieved enlightenment much earlier is now manifesting in many different places as many different people and so forth.
Beings in the Deva realm and the Asura and then Preta and Naraka, what conditions need to be present for them to be liberated from the realms that they're in?
You're right, okay. So generally, as I mentioned earlier, in the animal Preta Naraka realm, generally there's too much suffering and often not enough cognitive ability anyway to do much. And in the Asura and Deva realm, often there's too much pleasure, there's no motivation to do anything because, you know, life's good. What do I need to do? And they live a long time. But as I think mentioned in the text here, particularly in the Deva realm, So remember we said that to be reborn there, of course, you have to do a lot of good things, you know. But in the Deva realm, every time you have a pleasant experience, you're burning up a positive imprint. And here, of course, there's no motivation to do anything, so they don't. So they don't replenish the stock. So meaning at the beginning of the life, they may have a lot of heavy good imprints, bad imprints quite light. But as in their long, long life of pleasure, they're burning up a lot of imprints. So what happens is over the course of their life, this happens. And it's said that they have some ability of mind, meaning when they're close to finishing that life, they see that this has happened and that they're actually going to end up down here somewhere. And they have a lot of suffering because of that. That's, I think, mentioned in the text here. And then the question comes up, well, if we're down here somewhere, how do we ever get back to being a human? And the answer is very difficult, but not impossible. Because in these existences, it's difficult, not impossible, but it's very difficult to newly create the causes to become human. But remember, in the beginning of any life, they come into that life with lots of imprints. So one of those could then eventually ripen. So eventually then it will happen. But in the text, and the Buddha said, so it can take a long, long, long time. That's why, reflecting on this precious human life, we can understand we're here now, and according to this sort of system of understanding, to be here actually is like almost impossible. So now we're here, let's make sure we stay here. Because we don't know if we're going to get back here for a long time. So how do we do that is what we've just covered. We have ethical lifestyle. We stop harming others, we engage in virtuous actions, we purify negative behaviour. That will go a long way to continue to ensure that we end up here in the future again. That's small capacity person. But of course, now we're in the medium capacity, even these existences still got problems, you know, and that we can actually go beyond all of this. That's where we are now.
But we can go off beyond all of that in one lifetime, because
technically possible.
If you go up to the Deva and you don't have, or Deva, and you don't have the memory of all the work you did in the past, then, I mean, I would think you would go up so you could go then even further the next, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. Prince Siddhartha, when he left the palace, he had a number of teachers. And a lot of the traditions at that time were saying, what you need to do is you need to go up here, because up here somewhere is liberation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So he developed all these concentrations and got to the top here and saw that, actually, no, that these concentrations do a very good job of not allowing any mental afflictions to arise, because if the mind is very focused and peaceful, there's no conditions for any mental afflictions to arise, but we haven't got rid of them. We're just keeping them under wraps because of our concentration. Then eventually, as the concentration deteriorates a bit, they'll start coming up again. So that's what Prince Siddhartha understood, that merely concentration practice is not going to get it. We have to get to the root of samsara, which we're going to look at tomorrow, this ignorance. And unless we tackle that, unless we develop wisdom, then merely concentration is just going to give us a sort of a little bit of a respite in samsara for some time. Okay. I think that's all I wanted to cover. We've just come to the end of today. So tomorrow, what we're going to do, of course, is continue on with the person of medium capacity. And we're going to look down here on page... We have to go back up. Yeah. We're going to start on page 17 in the middle there. We're going to now then look at the second noble truth, the truth of the causal origin. So in particular, we're going to look at how the mental afflictions are the source, We're going to, as the outlines say here, what are these mental afflictions? How do they arise? And how do they lead to suffering or dukkha? So we're going to spend a lot of time tomorrow looking at the mental afflictions, particularly the three core mental afflictions of ignorance, attachment and aversion, in particular anger. We're going to look at the whole process of how that leads to suffering. So you may like to tonight also have a look at your handout, the suffering and its causes chart. So we're going to be going through that tomorrow. And then also we are going to, what else are we going to look at tomorrow? We're going to look at how also we can, in a practical way, deal with our mental afflictions, particularly this attachment, aversion and anger. And then in the afternoon, we're going to move on to look at the whole death-rebirth process. So that's explained a little bit in your text here on page 18, how you die and are reborn. So we're going to go through the whole death-rebirth process tomorrow afternoon. So that's the. So there's not much to read here, but we're going to be doing a lot of talking tomorrow about the mental afflictions and the death-rebirth process. Yeah.
You're going to cover the
12
dependent arising?
Probably the following morning we're going to cover that. I mean, of course we're going to cover it. We're going to cover these 12 links because that's also a way of understanding how we're stuck in samsara. Depends on how far we get through the material tomorrow, but I anticipate it'll be the next morning. But we're definitely going to cover it. We're going to actually talk about this whole diagram in a lot more detail. So that probably will be the following morning. But yes, we're going to talk about that. So you might also like to read a little bit. I think it's on two sides, your handout. There's a description, a lot of description of this is on the second page of your handout. So you might like to also read a little bit about that this evening as well, if you have some time. So that's the subject material for tomorrow. And then we'll have a break. And now then you're going to meditate a little bit on this, some of the aspects of suffering. And then following that, the 10 virtues. So reflecting on those 10 virtues for the ethical lifestyle. And then this evening, having a look at this Vajrasattva practice, this purification practice and the four opponent powers. So that's this evening. So have a break, and I'll see you back tomorrow morning.